Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Eating disorders, including anorexia and bulimia, have been part of our conversations around health and diet for many years. But the landscape is changing as ever younger kids report worrying about their weight, and new disorders like orthorexia have grown from the fitness craze. And along with these changes, ever-present social media is playing a huge role with a constant stream of images showing people exactly how their bodies measure up compared to others. This hour in the Exchange, what eating disorders are like today, who gets them, and how some tools, like technology, can both help and hurt recovery. Let's hear from you. We'd love to hear your stories, personal experiences, questions. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests with us in studio. Is Monica Ostroff. She's director of the Cambridge Eating Disorders Center of New Hampshire. She's a therapist, author, and consultant specializing in eating disorders. And Monica, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Also with us, Jesse Felber, senior at UNH, who received treatment for an eating disorder while in college. Jesse's now studying social work. And Jesse, I know it's close to graduation, so thank you for making time.
Thanks.
Also joining us by phone, Bess O'Brien, director of a film called All of Me, a documentary about eating disorders. Bess has also directed and produced several other films, including The Hungry Heart, about the prescription drug crisis in Vermont. All of Me will be shown at South Church on State Street in Portsmouth at 7 p.m. this Friday. If you want to attend that event, there's more information on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And Bess O'Brien, welcome. Good to have you.
Thanks so much.
Well, let's talk first of all just who is likely to develop an eating disorder, because Monica, the image that most of us have is a teenage girl.
Not so much the case anymore.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I think for quite some time, you know, we have seen younger people getting eating disorders as well. I remember like 17 years ago being at Hampstead Hospital directing the program there, we would get calls for eight-year-olds.
Eight-year-olds?
Yep. And we've treated people, you know, at Cambridge, we don't treat under the age of 12, but we've had people from 12 all the way up to 62 on our program. Lots of middle-aged women, men, people of all ethnicities and races. Eating disorders are no longer the average white, middle-class, well-to-do woman who's quote-unquote worried about her looks. I think that was a fallacy all along.
What do you think is behind that? Well, it sounds like you say it's a fallacy all along, but behind that image, because that's definitely the face that we have.
Sure. You mean in general, you know, what does it sort
sure.
of look like? I mean, the person who gets an eating disorder, so to speak, is it's a multifaceted sort of thing where it's, we used to give an analogy saying genetics loads the gun. Well, you know, the environment pulls the trigger and the American public is standing around screaming, shoot, shoot, which speaks to the hostility of recovery in the environment today. So if you think about people who are genetically loaded to be predisposed for an eating disorder, that can be anyone. We note that those genes are correlated to alcoholism and addiction, depression and anxiety. There's new research that's being done on pathways in the brain that look fairly similar to addiction in some ways. We're understanding more about that. And then oftentimes something in the environment will trigger those genes or set them off. It can be a traumatic event, but it can also be the very simple biological act of going on a diet and trying to lose weight. If you have the set of genes, just dieting can turn that eating disorder on.
Well, it's interesting, and we'll hear later on some clips from Bess's film about family members who say things that aren't always helpful, and sometimes that's a trigger. But
sure.
In the film, Greenberg-Benjamin, she's director of the Vermont Center for Integrative Therapy. She describes what she sees, the personality traits common with an eating disorder. Let's hear.
There definitely seems to be, over the last 17 years that I've been doing this, there seems to be some sort of consistency with the way people show up in being very bright, very self-aware, very capable, very beautiful, very overachieving and striving, and often very sensitive and sensitized to others, very attuned to other people's needs.
Again, that's a clip from All of Me. It's a new documentary about eating disorders made by Bess O'Brien. And Bess, what about that clip? What types of people did you meet in the process of producing this film?
Well, I think Monica is right. I mean, I think that what we thought probably all the way back to Karen Carpenter, because Karen Carpenter from The Carpenters, which was, I think, in the late 70s, died from anorexia. And that was sort of the first time that, to me, I don't know what you think, Monica or Jesse, but it was the first time, I think, that we really, it became a big deal, eating disorders. And of course, Karen Carpenter was thin. She was a celebrity. She was beautiful. And I think we tend, even now in this culture, when we think of eating disorders, to think about, you know, the front page of People magazine where, you know, there's a headline saying, does Angelina Jolie have an eating disorder? And we forget that it's happening all around us in our families and with our friends. In my film, I interviewed 32 people from ages 15 to 55, so people who were just starting out, people who had been struggling with this issue all of their lives, and I also interviewed men and boys, and there is a boy in the film who's particularly is the one person that I decided to focus on, and he was, at the time that I interviewed him, actually, I think, 14. And there's all kinds of different shapes and sizes of people in my film. I think that what Bree is saying there is that I did find that no matter what sort of shape, size, or where you came from, or if you're male, that these people are very smart, capable, very sensitive people who I think that is in some ways some of the underlying issues around eating disorders. There are many, many underlying issues around eating disorders. But if you were to watch the film, and of course I spent 6 months interviewing these people, I mean, they are extremely articulate and very aware, as I'm sure Jesse is, and very, in many times, are very successful at what they're doing. I mean, one of the women that I interviewed, was a senior at Wesleyan College, and, you know, straight-A student and about to go into a very high-powered job in New York City and had been suffering desperately for years with anorexia.
Wow.
And so it's one of the sort of ironies sometimes of eating disorders is that people, and I think one of the ways that people get away with having eating disorders for so long is that many times they're extremely capable, smart, and can function in the world for quite a long time before people realize that they are struggling with a major problem.
Well, Jesse, and let's hear your story. And again, thank you for coming in to share it. When did you first develop an eating disorder and how did that come about?
Yeah, so I think that what everyone said about kind of the general personality of someone with an eating disorder really rings true for me. So growing up, I was always kind of an anxious kid, always a perfectionist, high achiever. And in college, when I went through that really huge life transition, my anxiety really increased. I really wanted to excel in school and do really well in my classes. And that pressure was a really huge weight to bear. And so I think that my eating disorder started my freshman year of college as a way to cope with the amount of pressure that I was putting on myself. And I think it's true that I was a really high functioning person for a while when I had my eating disorder, too, because it was helping me cope with these things that were really hard to deal with. I was going to all my classes, getting a 4.0, able to connect with family, but I was really struggling on the inside and was kind of going to bed every night wondering, when is this ever going to get better?
Wow. So a lot of people eat when they're under stress, but your way of coping with anxiety and wanting to perform and be perfect at school was to not eat.
Yeah, so I think that I was kind of looking for a way to to get rid of that, the weight and the pressure that was on me. And so for me, food and exercise kind of became that way to deal with that stress. So I actually remember sitting in a college nutrition course and learning about diets and learning about what the correct way of eating was and looking at that as an opportunity to kind of make my diet and exercise regimen perfect. And for someone that isn't predispositioned to have an eating disorder, a class like that might not be a problem at all. But when I was then going through a diet analysis project and seeing kind of where the imperfections in my diet and in my exercise patterns lied, that was really dangerous for me and is what kind of sent me spiraling into a full-blown battle with anorexia.
So I have to ask you this because we did a show last week on sort of digital addiction. Did you use a Fitbit?
I did, and it was really bad for me.
Because this guy who wrote this book about digital addiction said Fitbits do tend to feed into this sort of obsession with, you know, how many steps, how many calories, you know, whatever you're measuring. People who've been concerned about weight have always measured. I mean, people had paper logs of how much they ate and how much they worked out. But he says that having it right there on your wrist all the time only makes it worse.
Yeah, and that's definitely true for someone with an eating disorder. And that is something that continues to be a struggle today when I'm going into work or into classrooms and I have friends doing Fitbit challenges. And that's something that I have to remind myself that having a Fitbit, again, will never be a good idea for me.
Well, and I want to let everybody know you're not wearing one right now. So
correct.
Lots more to talk about. And I want to play a lot more clips from Bess's film. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. The exchange number for you to be with our conversation today is 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at eating disorders, how diagnosis, treatment, and prevention look today, especially in our social media and internet technology filled culture. A new documentary called All of Me by one of our guests, Bess O'Brien, will examine this. It'll be shown in Portsmouth on Friday. And of course, if you want more information, you can go to our website, nhpr.org. You can join us now with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at @NHPRExchange. Monica, how common is Jesse's experience?
I think it's, you know, pretty common, and I'd say maybe if I had to ballpark it, about 70-75% of the people that we see at the Cambridge Eating Disorder Center and throughout the years that I've been in practice. You know, it's also important to recognize that a lot of people that we see are people that have access to care. And in New Hampshire, we definitively have access to care issues. So I think since we've been more able to treat people with New Hampshire Medicaid, for example, with the expansion of New Hampshire Medicaid and people getting more access to care, our center is seeing different profiles. So we are seeing people who are living in poverty, people who are not, who don't necessarily fit that high achieving kind of stereotype that we've seen over time. I'm seeing an awful lot of co-occurring addiction disorders along with eating disorders that are active.
What does that mean exactly? Co-occurring.
Co-occurring meaning they have an active addiction, potentially an opiate addiction, cocaine addiction, alcoholism,
really?
Along with their eating disorder. When you think about it, you know, a family member of someone had summed it up kind of nicely about their own addiction, saying, I drink or take drugs to change how I feel. Well, eating disorder symptoms do the same thing. If you engage in an eating disorder behavior of some sort, that's going to change your emotional state. It's going to change how you feel. Like Jesse pretty beautifully said, you know, I started, you know, restricting and over-exercising to, quote, take the weight off my shoulders. And she was literally taking the weight off of her body.
You know, Bess, you have done other documentaries, including one on prescription drug addiction. So what are the parallels that you see between addiction and eating disorders?
Oh, yeah, there's definitely parallels. And co-occurring does happen a lot. I think that it's all about filling our hungry heart. It's about, you know, we do not feel good about ourselves. We're dealing with depression, anxiety, pain, trauma, you name it. And we are overwhelmed or we don't have the resources to deal with it or we don't know how to deal with it. And, you know, when somebody offers you an oxycodone or cocaine or a bottle of beer or says, if you don't eat, you're going to actually numb yourself out and feel like you're in control of your life when you may feel out of control in your life. These are all coping mechanisms. They're not good coping mechanisms, but they are coping mechanisms. And so it's very, yes, we see many times people, in fact, there's somebody, I have a special feature in my film about a woman who struggles with being overweight. And ironically, she was in another one of my movies as a heroin addict. And she says in the film that getting over heroin was easier at some level than getting over her eating disorder. Because here's the deal. With other addictions, you can put the addiction, the actual thing away. You say, I'm not going to do heroin anymore, or I'm not going to drink that wine anymore. You set it aside. But you can't do that with food. You have to eat food. You have to deal with food. You have to look at food 7 to 10 times a day at least, and struggle through it. And that is a huge difference, in my opinion, in the recovery, the difference between recovery from a drug addiction and an eating disorder, because every day you're having something trigger you that you have to deal with. And that is a huge challenge. I mean, it's like Jessie saying she's walking into the classroom and people are on their Fitbits. I mean, that's a trigger. People are so obsessed with food. Food is everywhere. We eat food. It's a healthy thing, too. People need to eat food.
Right.
But you can't get rid of it.
So I read that nearly 50% of people diagnosed with eating disorders also have symptoms of some other problem, whether it's depression, another mental health issue. Did you find this to be true for you, Jessie? Were there other issues going on that sort of were fueling this eating disorder?
Yeah, I would probably say in the beginning, it was definitely just really intense anxiety. I mean, my freshman year of college, I couldn't go back to my dorm room sometimes because I would get so anxious, and I would be running out of classrooms halfway through because I would just be overcome with moments of panic attack. And I think that at first, you think that your eating disorder is all about the food, and you think that maybe the media just told me that I just can't eat bagels and that they're this dangerous thing to come near. But what I really learned through treatment and as time has gone on, that my eating disorder has really been a maladaptive coping skill for the level of anxiety that I have sometimes. And that's really hard to recognize at first, because dealing with the anxiety can be a lot harder than just keeping it about the food.
Yeah, it makes sense. So it's really not about the food. It's a coping mechanism, a strange one for those of us not involved, but it's a coping mechanism. What was your treatment like? How do you even sort of unbend your mind around this thing?
Yeah, treatment was it was really difficult. I'm really grateful, because I definitely believe that it's the reason that I'm kind of back in action today and doing really well. But it was hard. I think that the hardest thing about going into treatment is that, one, at first you can really be in a battle with your mind that you don't feel like you're entitled to be there, that you don't feel like you're sick enough. And that's partly comes from the one education that you often get in elementary school and high school education is these pictures of eating disorders with these really emaciated people. And it's just kind of just showing you that the world associates anorexia with these people that are severely underweight, when really eating disorders come in all shapes and sizes. Another barrier to even getting there is the body dysmorphia. So people were telling me that I didn't look good and I didn't look healthy, but that wasn't what I was seeing when I was looking in the mirror. And it took a really long time to be convinced that my body weight wasn't in a healthy place. And then also, when you're going to treatment, you're passing over the control to other people, and you're telling them, hey, right now, I don't know how to feed myself. I don't know how to take care of myself, and I need you to help me do that. And that's really difficult when your eating disorder is there in the first place to make you feel like you have control. And I think that the place that I had to come to in my treatment was that I knew that I wasn't happy. No matter what I was doing, I had great things going on. But I had to be able to pass over that control in order to better my life again.
Wow, it does sound similar to how other people start to work through other addictions. A lot more to talk about after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, eating disorders. In the past decade, treatment and prevention have undergone many changes, but patients, parents, and peers still face a lot of challenges. We're finding out more, and we're hearing a few clips from a new documentary called All of Me, Examining Eating Disorders. It'll be shown in Portsmouth at 7 on Friday night. And for more information, you can go to our website, nhpr.org. You can join us now at 1-800-892-6477. Your questions, comments about eating disorders are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at nhprexchange. And all of you, before we go to our listeners, Jesse, I did want to give you a chance to finish up that thought that you were presenting when you were going through treatment for your eating disorder, just how hard it was for you to give up control because you were such a high-performing person.
Yeah, absolutely. So going to treatment for me meant cutting back in school and taking some time away from my friends and from the classes that I was trying really hard to achieve in. And that was really a difficult choice to make. But once I made that choice, it was almost easier to just have relinquished that control and just to know that I had this awesome team of professionals that were going to help me and help restore me back to health. So I think that the entire process, though, was kind of a battle in my mind of going back to wanting that control, going back to wanting that comfort and having a body that was underweight and fitting kind of society standards, to letting these team of professionals that I know really cared about me and really wanted to help me help get me back where I needed to be.
Talk a little bit more about body dysmorphia and what that's like, Jesse.
Yeah, so I think that one of the hard things about having an eating disorder and having it be undiagnosed is that you don't necessarily know that you're experiencing body dysmorphia. So body dysmorphia is basically when you're looking in the mirror and you're not seeing yourself how you actually are. A lot of times this can happen from hyper-focusing on certain parts of your body. So they're going to start looking a lot bigger than they actually are. And that's all about what an eating disorder is. Like when you have an eating disorder, a lot of times you'll be checking certain areas of your body to see if they're growing after you had that dinner. So it's very real and it's really debilitating. And that's why in treatment you do a lot of thought checking and you're able to kind of raise those concerns and those feelings that you're having and kind of check them with professionals.
Wow. So even after one dinner, you might look at your thighs and say, are they bigger after that dinner?
Absolutely. Sometimes like during the meal too.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yep.
Well, here's an email that came in from Andrea, and I'll throw this to you, Monica. Andrea says, I have a 7-year-old daughter who is a perfectionist. How do I protect her from getting an eating disorder? Is that possible? Thank you, Andrea, so much. I'm sure it's a question a lot of parents have.
I don't know that we can guarantee that you can definitively prevent an eating disorder, but certainly I think there are a number of things you can do to minimize the likelihood. You know, the first is to take a look at your own views about food and your body, to understand that all foods are fine in moderation, to not have good and bad foods in your house. You know, certainly today there's this big push towards preventing obesity, so there's a lot of, you know, don't eat cookies, don't eat candy, eat fruits and vegetables. And sure, fruits and vegetables obviously are beautiful and nutritionally dense and good for you. But at the same time, there's plenty of room in a quote-unquote meal plan or diet for some quote-unquote junk food or fun foods. And those, you know, need to be consumed in moderation and have a good attitude about those. Take a look at, you know, how you're thinking about your body. Do you have an ornamental view of your body or an instrumental view of your body? And by that, I mean, if you think about how women dress, you know, we hang dangly earrings. I mean, I'm wearing them right now, right? We have bracelets on our wrists. We wear high heels that are completely uncomfortable to walk in, yet we wear them. And then you look at how most men dress. You know, they dress much more functionally so that they can move and bend and lift things. And I think that, you know, women, we need to also think about what our bodies do for us rather than how we look all of the time.
Ornamental versus instrumental. That's beautifully put.
It kind of captures it, right? Like we're not trees that we're decorating, yet we do that to ourselves as females. But we do have functional bodies that get us through our day. And how can we, I know, help our children and ourselves to really maximize what our bodies can do for us?
Well, let's hear another clip from Bess's film, because this comes up a lot with the people that you interviewed, Bess. And several women interviewed in the documentary describe what you talked about, Monica, their mother's own issues with food and how that influenced these women's thinking. So let's hear.
Well, My mother, she would see somebody and she'd say, "Whoa, do I look as fat as them? Am I as heavy as that person?" And even if she was, or even if she was more heavy, we always said, "Oh, no, Mom."
I remember her telling me stories about how for meals she would only drink chicken broth and then a piece of cheese. And just being like, remembering, wow, like my mom was able to have so much willpower.
My mom was not happy with her weight, and we would do like group diet things.
I think we tried just about everything. The Atkins diet, at one point, the not eating diet where you just don't, or you only eat drinks or shakes.
Again, a clip from Bess O'Brien's new documentary called All of Me. It'll be shown on Friday in Portsmouth. Talking about, and Bess, I want to hear real quick from you too on this, how what parents say, not just about their sons or daughters, but about themselves influences kids. It's really hard.
Oh, it is so hard. It is so hard. I mean, we've been touring this film now for 5 months, and we've had a lot of conversations with audience members, and a lot of parents talk about this. You know, obviously you want your kids to eat healthy foods, but, you know, then if you're bugging them and saying, you know, you can't have dessert unless you eat everything on your plate, depending on your kid and where they're coming from and if they're if they're particularly sensitive or have high anxiety or are anxious, you know, that could help trigger this. I think that part of what I did in the first 15 minutes of the film was actually sort of go back in time, because obviously this issue didn't just happen yesterday. I mean, women and men, frankly, but particularly women in our society have been dieting for centuries, probably, but certainly for, you know, we know that diet is such a huge thing, and we grow up many times in households where the family is on a diet, or the mother is constantly talking about her weight. And of course, I mean, just like anything else, kids pick up this stuff and they think, okay, if that's what my mom's doing, then that's what I should do. I mean, the other thing that my film touches on in the beginning is just, you know, things that we hear and what people tell us when we're young, you know, on the playground, or you know, there's a couple of women talking about how when they were little, they loved a particular dress, and, you know, their aunt or a friend or somebody said, "Oh, you can't wear that dress. You know, you don't look good in that dress, or it doesn't fit you," or whatever. And, you know, obviously not everyone's going to be able to stop doing all of that, but we need to be aware that those little comments that we make can build up and they can impact people. And, you know, it's tough.
Well, Andrea, thank you so much for the email. Again, I'm sure it's a question on a lot of people's minds. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And all of you, let's go to Sandwich. Tim is on the air. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife and I are proud parents of two young men. One is 27 and recently married, and the other is 23, and he has been dealing with full-fledged anorexia for almost exactly 4 years now.
Wow.
And I thought that I could add a couple of layers to the conversation, in part because our son is male, obviously, and anorexia is affects both males and females, obviously, but it's more, as we have discovered, and it's been an education for us as well, it's sometimes exclusively seen as a young sort of teenage problem, and that's a myth that, of course, your guests understand needs to be exploded. But,
is he getting treatment, Tim?
We have been through every possible treatment. He was ironically rejected 3 years ago at the Cambridge Eating Disorder Center because he wasn't full enough along, as they put it. But it has been this cliche now. It has been for us an existential struggle. My wife and I are currently seeing a therapist who saw the four of us as a family therapist for a couple of years, but we've been to an eating disorder expert. My son is seeing both a therapist and a nutritionist. He is also at the, depending on your perspective, but he is at the top liberal arts college in the nation.
So one of those high-achieving young people again, like you, Jesse. Besk, let's talk about the guys. I mean, you say this right up in your film. It's not just teenage girls.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, I actually got quite a few calls from parents saying, I hope you're going to include boys and men in this because my son is struggling with this. But there's a lot of shame around that. You know, I mean, it's difficult for anybody to admit that they have an eating disorder, but men especially, because they haven't really come out of the closet and we haven't given them permission to do so. And, you know, the boy that's in my film started an eating disorder when he was about 13 or 14. He's still struggling with it. He's now 17. But it can happen any time. And one of the things that was really interesting is that at one of our screenings, somebody stood up and said, a man stood up and said, I'm Joe, and I'm in the Army, and a friend of mine came to visit me just recently, and we went out for pizza, and we had our pizza, and then he said, excuse me, you know, I'll be right back, and he left. And he didn't come back for like 20 minutes. And so this guy went and looked for him and found him around the corner throwing up and said, what are you doing? And essentially after pressing him, he said, I have bulimia.
Oh, my goodness.
So talk about a stereotype. I mean, this is like a big macho Army guy who is essentially has an eating disorder. So the point is that it can happen to anyone, anywhere. And, you know, for parents who are dealing with this issue, it's extremely difficult and very challenging.
Well, talk a little bit more, Bess, on what you said that men aren't supposed to or aren't allowed to use your language.
Well, I mean, I think it's you know, what everybody has been saying is that I think, first of all, there's decades of the idea that eating disorders are thin women and that it's all about dieting and body. And we know that that's not the case at all, that the food is part of the problem, but not at all the systemic problem. And I think that, you know, frankly, probably men have been struggling with this for longer than we knew. I mean, certainly athletes, I'm sure, have been struggling with eating disorders. I mean, you know, people who are wrestlers, you know, you have to be a certain weight, men's wrestling. And if you get above that weight, you can't be in that same team, you know. So, I mean, I'm sure this has been going on for a long, long time, and we just have not talked about it. But I also think that, frankly, this is just my opinion, but I think that Madison Avenue woke up probably 40 years ago and said, or 30 years ago, and said, wow, we've just been, you know, pushing this idea of thinness and a particular way that you look and dress on women. What about the whole other side of the population, which is men? Why don't we start focusing on them, too? And so now you see, you know, such a push on male physique, and you have to have a certain kind of muscle tone, and you have to wear this kind of clothing. And I think men have become way more pushed into the same place that women have for decades around, you know, advertising and marketing. And I think that that has helped, probably.
Well, real quick to you too, Monica, do you see a lot of male clients?
We definitely see them. I wouldn't say a lot compared with the number of women that we see. You know, we've only been open in New Hampshire for a year and a half. We opened August of 2015. So since that time, I believe we've treated 5 men and we've evaluated probably 2 or 3 others.
Wow, that's not very many.
It's really not. And I think sometimes men struggle with, you know, where do I get care? Do I go to a place that's specialized in only males with eating disorders, like Rogers Memorial, for example? Can I go anywhere? When I think about it, I kind of think about something that was said many years ago when I was in grad school, and they were talking about, oh, if you're a female and you're going to get treatment for addiction, you're likely to be treated by men. Hey, if you're a male with an eating disorder, you're likely to be treated by women.
So it feels uncomfortable for them.
Yeah, I think it really does. Although, you know, we've been really blessed with the men that have come into our facility. We have a very open, accepting, kind of lean-back community at CDC in New Hampshire. And I think that some of the stuff that they struggle with is very, very similar, you know, per their report. You know, they feel very accepted by their female peers and certainly by the staff. But we are an all-female staff right now at CDC of New Hampshire.
Interesting.
With the exception of our APRN, he is a male, or one of them.
When you were going through treatment, Jesse, you know, did you, you know, when you started to talk about this, you sort of came out about it. Did any guys open up to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of as Monica said, the guys that I was able to go to treatment with really opened up, and we had a lot of similarities in our journeys. I think that the great thing about seeking out treatment in a facility and in a program is that it tends to be a really good community, because often maybe you've been struggling for 2 years previously or more, and you're finally in a place where people understand what you're going through, and they understand the anxiety that you wake up with in the morning. And that's a feeling that I don't think that you can really understand unless you've been through an eating disorder or had a family member that has.
Well, all right. Thank you again for the call, Tim, and good luck to your son. The number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Cara's calling from Dover. Hi, Cara. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. I wanted to call in just, well, because I had kind of a long experience with an eating disorder, and previously you guys are talking about just the availability of care and how important that is. And I just kind of wanted to chime in and say that I was diagnosed with an eating disorder when I was 9 years old. And there was only one place in New Hampshire that was in reach for me and for my family. Because again, as a child, you can't drive yourself. So I was relying on my parents who had two other kids, and, you know, it was a lot. And I kind of had that, kind of didn't. And I ended up struggling with an eating disorder for about 15 years.
Wow, Cara.
Yeah, but when I was 22, after I graduated from college, I just kind of was like, I am done with this. And I decided to go, and this was right, actually, as Monica just said, right when CEDC in Concord opened up. And they opened up in August, and I was there in October. And I was there for about 3 months, maybe for like a little bit, but for 3 weeks full time. I took time off of work, which was definitely very difficult as a young adult, you know, 23 right out of school, being like, oh, hey, thanks for my full-time job, but I need to take some time off.
Yeah, 3 weeks. But you lived there then, Cara. It was inpatient. You were there.
It was, so the Concord one, yeah, yes. So it was 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., or 8, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m.
I see, so all day.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to still be living at home with my parents in Manchester. But after having access to that care and just that being able to take time off and do that, I, at this point, you know, a little over a year later, made a complete recovery. And that's something I didn't think was possible after 15 years. And I guess that I just wanted to kind of throw that home, that getting care and then the right amount of care and people, you know, attentive care and being open about it is so important, especially for a mental illness where it is kind of not talked about and not hidden. My mom used to say, you know, if you had cancer, you would treat cancer and no one would question it. And that's something that I think needs to be more treated, but we're kind of working towards with mental illness and eating disorders especially.
Well, Cara, I'm so glad to hear from you. Thank you for the call. And in just a moment, we should talk more about the different types of treatment, what recovery looks like, and we'll take a lot more of your calls at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Ideas come naturally to writers.
I wish.
But how are they with deadlines?
I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like, if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it.
Apparently, they're just like the rest of us. Whether you're looking for inspiration or commiseration, subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what eating disorders are like today in our social media-fueled culture where there's always another picture to compare yourself to. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. This Friday at 7, South Church in Portsmouth will have a showing about this issue, the documentary film called all of me, followed by a Q&A with producer Bess O'Brien. Bess O'Brien is with us this hour. She's the director of the documentary. She's also directed and produced several other films. Jessie Felber is also here. She's a senior at UNH who's been talking about her own struggles with an eating disorder. And Monica Ostroff is with us, director of the Cambridge Eating Disorder Center of New Hampshire and a therapist, author, and consultant specializing in eating disorders. One more time, that number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, our caller just before the break, Cara, talked about the types of treatment that she got and what recovery looks like. And Monica, let's talk about that. We've had so many programs on, you know, alcohol addiction, opioid addiction, other types of drug addiction. And those folks say you're always in recovery. You're never recovered or completely cured. What about eating disorders? Can you be fully recovered and sit down and enjoy a Thanksgiving meal?
I hope so, because I am.
You had your own struggle,
right?
I
did, yeah. For a long time, I had a pretty severe eating disorder. Most people know that. It's published in books that I've written. For years, they used to give statistics of, for an eating disorder, you know, one-third would stay chronically ill, one-third would be in and out of recovery, one-third would recover. Then over time, those statistics have kind of morphed to look a little more like about 83% of people recover. Average length of recovery takes about 5 years. You know, in my experience, certainly, I think there was a phase of what I would call symptom abstinence, where your head's still kind of a mess, or those thoughts are still kind of up front or in the middle of your brain. And through time, you know, they really do move to the back of your head and kind of go away. I can sit here pretty securely and say, I don't think about food. I don't think about weight. Unfortunately, people on the radio can't see me, but I am normal weight for my height and have been for quite some time. And I'm eat a wide variety of foods very comfortably without thinking about it. And, you know, do I think, though, that my genes could be reactivated if for some reason I got very ill and lost weight? Yeah, that's a possibility. You know, I think that you need to be prudent when you're in full recovery, that if you get a horrible stomach bug and you lose X number of pounds, you do need to be diligent about putting those back on to keep yourself at your ideal body weight.
Instead of saying, oh, good, look, I lost some weight.
Well, yeah, and hopefully you won't be saying that if you're in full recovery. But, you know, I think that there is, I didn't believe this when I was struggling, but, you know, certainly now that I'm recovered and working in the field, everybody kind of has a magic number that they need to be at or above in order for their brain to be healthy when they think about food. And I lived through that. So there was a place where I wanted to be when I was in early recovery. And I think my head was a little weird, but probably looked normal according to American society standards around females and food. And then I went over that particular number and found...
That number on the scale.
That number on the scale, correct. And found that the way I thought and felt completely changed.
Like how so?
That there are things that I used to sort of obsess or worry about, you know, when I was under a certain number that was still... For what it's worth, it was still in a healthy range. You know, I think my BMI might have been about 18 or 19 at that, probably 19 at that point in time. And really, once you hit a BMI of at least 20, and now they're saying research-wise, 20 to 22 is the BMI that we're shooting for people who are underweight, who need to weight restore. You really, you're able to think a lot better, and you're able to process information a lot better. And things like numbers on the scale and food components just really stop bothering you when you're healthy. And I should say, dealing with your emotions in a healthy way. You know, we live in a society where I think that it's not particularly well accepted that you struggle with emotions or that you're open with your emotions. You know, women who are angry, for example, are called derogatory names. Men who cry are also called derogatory names. And I think we need to be a little bit better about embracing all of our emotions.
So our emotional expressions are limited, often, as you say, by gender.
Mm-hmm.
And then that gets sort of mixed up inside and can turn into an eating disorder.
Right. And that's further fueled by an eating disorder, right? If you think about restriction or binging and purging as numbing out feelings, you stuff yourself with feelings, you're so overwhelmed with feelings, you get rid of those feelings through purging.
Wow.
Or you numb yourself out. You know, when we get to a place where we understand that all emotions are okay and we can cope with them in healthy ways and soothe ourselves through them until they shift, change, and pass, we're going to be a lot healthier.
Do you feel recovered, Jessie, using the past tense? Or are you in recovery?
I would definitely say that I'm in recovery. I still have to do a lot of kind of work to maintain my recovery. I see a dietitian and a therapist and a psychiatrist pretty frequently, and I have days that are really difficult. One thing that I still do is I follow a meal plan, and that's a really important part for I would say a more in like middle recovery, but for early to middle, and it kind of just depends on the person. You can't eat intuitively. Sometimes I still have really low hunger cues, and that's something that may not ever come back to normal. And so I use a meal plan because it feels structured and it helps me. So like, especially right now, the last month of the semester, there's a lot of life stress. I'm transitioning out of school and going to find a job, and that's stressful. And my mind's natural way to cope is to go back to, okay, maybe I don't need that snack, or maybe we could skip breakfast. So having a meal plan and having that follow-up with a dietitian is really important for me to keep myself healthy.
Interesting. Well, we've touched on this throughout the hour, but I want to hit on it a little bit more. And this is the idea, again, of media influence, whether we're talking, you know, old-fashioned magazines or, you know, scrolling for your Facebook feed and looking at other bodies and comparisons and so forth. Bess touches on this a lot in the film. Many of the women that you interviewed, Bess, for the documentary talk about how media and that constant stream of pictures impacted their eating disorders. Let's hear.
In high school, I used to watch The Biggest Loser and America's Next Top Model.
I would cut the stomach parts out of the Victoria's Secret catalog, and I like put it on my mirror as like a, like, you can do this.
Women, you know, they put up pictures of models because that's their thinspiration. I'm gonna look like that, and that's what's gonna drive me. Well, now it's like the fitspiration. Everyone's working out, and you're working out, but you look like toned. And some of the pictures are like these women who, I see them like in a gym picture, and I'm like, you look like that when you go to the gym. I don't even look that good when I like get ready to go to a prom.
It's very autopilot. Just, you know, you're in class and you're bored, so you look at your phone and you see a picture of like a hot model, and you don't think about it, but in your head you're like, very, you know, very subconsciously, you say to yourself, wow, I wish that I looked like that.
Again, that's a clip from Bess O'Brien's film, a new documentary called All of Me. And Bess, let's talk about that a little bit more. You know, when I was a teenager, obviously we had, you know, magazines that we would look at and so forth. But now you've just got pictures everywhere, all the time, every second of the day.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that also we need to, it's been alluded to a little bit, but, you know, the exercise workout thing has also become sort of overboard. You know, we all need exercise. Going to the gym is great, but part of many women who have eating disorders also way over exercise, and that is part of their eating disorder. I mean, a lot of the women that I had interviewed in the film, you know, would exercise, would go to the gym and exercise or run for like 5-6 hours a day. I mean, I don't even know how they did it. But, you know, so I think that we have this tendency in this country to come up with these ideas, which in some ways are fine. You know, we want to look good, we want to dress nicely, we want to be fit, we want to eat the right foods. And then for some reason, they just get completely gonzo. And people, you know, I mean, I think that the woman in the film who said, my God, I mean, the way you're supposed to look when you go work out at the gym, I mean, you're supposed to be a goddess, you know. Most people are just going to the gym to, like, you know, get some good air through their lungs and, you know, get themselves in decent shape. But this idea that we have to be perfect and look a certain way is very difficult. And the other thing I would say is I think that the whole Fitbit thing also is part of the new media, because once again, for people who are healthy and want to lose a little weight or want to, you know, get exercising more, that can be very helpful. But put into the wrong hands, it can be extremely detrimental. I mean, one of the girls in my film talks about how every day at the University of Vermont, she would sit down with a bunch of her friends, and they would take their little, I don't think it was a Fitbit. I think it was another sort of dieting app, and what you would do is you would put in I'm eating a peanut butter sandwich, milk, and 2 cookies. It would add up the calories, and then it would tell you exactly how to burn it off. Like if you do, you know, 72 jumping jacks, all those calories will go away, supposedly. And so this woman said in the movie, she said, so the idea was we ate And then we figured out how to get rid of all the calories that we just ate. So it's like you didn't eat anything.
Wow.
You know,
but you need food. I mean, your body needs to function with the food.
That's right.
That's so interesting. And again, people have always sort of done that. I mean, those charts have been around forever. But I want to let you know, Bess, that as you were talking about that, both Monica and Jesse were kind of nodding. I mean, Jesse, did you use this thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one thing that people don't realize as part of an eating disorder sometimes is actually exercise purging. And so that's exactly what it is. It's looking at the food you've eaten by the numbers and then running X amount of miles to burn that food off. And that's exactly how my mind thought. And when I was in the depths of my eating disorder, I saw food as fuel for me to run an excessive amount of miles and kind of totally discounted the fact that my body needed food for my heart to beat and for my organs to function.
For your brain.
Yeah, but I think in the media, it's often like we're kind of taught that food should be about diet and food should be about making your body look a certain way, when the reality is food is supposed to be nourishing and it's supposed to be keeping your body at homeostasis.
Yeah. And there's always been charts that say, you know, if you want to eat a donut, you need to walk, you know, for 2 hours or whatever. I mean, we've always had that, but it's a lot easier to get to today. And so while we're on this, Monica, I wonder, what about older people who you see who, you know, maybe aren't as into, you know, tracking everything or measuring everything or, you know, checking everything on social media? Is it easier for them to recover from an eating disorder, or does it not matter?
You'd actually be surprised. A lot of those people have their own Fitbits and their own MyFitnessPals and are actually on social media. Even, you know, if they're 60 years old, they are weighing and measuring and looking at, you know, we call it, you know, compare and despair.
Compare yourself
to somebody else in fear of despair, because that's pretty much what happens. You're not honoring your own unique individuality. You're trying to be somebody else. And it's interesting. I had found this statistic that, you know, 80% of Americans watch TV every day, right? And that on a typical day for 8 to 18-year-olds, they watch or they consume 7.5 hours of media every day. So if you're thinking about comparing and despairing, that's 7.5 hours of comparing and despairing
in a
day.
There's plenty of opportunity. Yeah. A couple more emails have come in. Here's one from Rebecca and Bo. And Rebecca, I'm not going to read the whole thing, even though what you said is great. But just in the interest of time, Rebecca says, I believe the eating disorder is brought out as the child tries to cope with adverse experiences of childhood. The child who encounters the latter, being raised in a dysfunctional environment to include codependency, domestic violence, verbal and emotional abuse, addiction, mentally and physically illness, suicide, etc., they create a culture which is impossible for a child to understand. Our families and culture carry generations of dysfunctional feelings of inadequacy, shame, secrecy, and denial. So Rebecca says, basically, to her, it's all about dysfunction. What do you think, Monica?
I think that that feels true for a very large number of people. But I've been doing this work for 20 years now. And in my various different directorships and in private practice, I have certainly seen, quite a few people who would say, hey, you know what, I don't really know why I have an eating disorder. I have a really good life. And that certainly seemed to be the case. And then at the same time, points well taken. There's a large number of people that do have traumatic experiences, addiction, all kinds of other things going on in their families.
Well, in the film, there's a lot of parents that Bess talked to, and a lot of them do not seem like, you know, horrible parents who are creating these terrible environments for their children. They seem stunned. They seem surprised. They seem, you know, like we love our daughter or son. We try to, you know, be supportive and warm and loving and so forth. So let's just hear from some of the parents in Bess's film about how difficult it's been to figure out what their children are going through.
You're not sure if you should talk about food, not talk about food. Why don't you eat? Why don't you eat more? And that just almost feeds into it.
The more I said, you are too thin, you know, you do look sick, you are not healthy, the more I was saying that, the more I was reinforcing the eating disorder, and I didn't know that at that time.
If I would say anything, like, do you want another roll, it could result in
her leaving
the plate flying across the table.
Don't try and, like, control their diet, because that's going to make it worse.
Because they're taking away these coping mechanisms, like, they're very unhealthy ones, but you can't just take them away from someone overnight.
You really have to think before you say something, because the automatic things that a parent would say to a child who hasn't eaten
enough, not there, right?
You can't do that.
It goes against every fiber in your body as a mother to not feed your child.
You're watching somebody not eat enough and that I've spent my life feeding this child. And I knew what I should and shouldn't say. And ultimately, I failed.
Again, a collection of parents in Bess O'Brien's film called All of Me. Talk about how difficult it was. And Bess, real quick, because we're nearing the end of the hour, just I feel their pain. You know, they don't want to say anything, but the kid doesn't look very good. And it's incredibly frustrating.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, I would be so bad at this if I had a kid with an eating disorder. Yeah, because, I mean, as I said, the first thing you want to say is, oh, my God, you know, you have to eat more, you're losing weight, or, you know, you're not eating enough at the dinner table or whatever. I mean, these are just, like, ingrained things that are, like, at the basic caring, nurturing point of what parents do for their kids. And so I guess what I would say is that, you know, what we need to remember is that parents also need therapy. They also need to be included in having support systems, because we often, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, drug addiction or, you know, eating disorders or whatever, we tend to focus on the person who's struggling with the disorder, which is perfectly understandable and fine, but we forget that the entire family is affected by these diseases, and that is huge. And,
well, it's what our caller, you know, Tim said earlier, sure, that they were all working on this, and what Rebecca mentions also in her email. Bess, I'm going to cut it off there, but good luck with the film, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Bess O'Brien. Again, her documentary is called All of Me. If you want more information about that Portsmouth showing, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Jesse Felber, good luck with graduation
coming up,
and thank you so much for being here. That's Jesse Felber, senior at UNH. She's now studying social work. And Monica Ostroff, it was really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Monica Ostroff, director of the Cambridge Eating Disorder Center of New Hampshire. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.